Hello, this is John St. Germain. Welcome to Crystal Silence League Radio. And we're having some connection trouble, it seems, so hopefully you can hear me. This week we're continuing our discussion of Ghost in the Machine, Part 2, The Nature of Consciousness, and Do We or Do We Not Exist? Are we just a function of the brain, or is there actually a spirit in there somewhere that activates the machine, that operates the machine? In other words, are we a computer running a program, or does the program exist independently of the computer? I do hope you stick around for this discussion. Grab your crystal balls and your crystals and your beverages. Thanks for waiting for us. I'm glad to be back. Last week we were gone. I had surgery 1 week ago today, in fact, and I'm glad to be back in the saddle this week. So have a little break. Enjoy this brief musical interlude and come back and join us in about 1 minute. Hey, and we're back. Thanks for holding on. Thanks for waiting. This is Crystal Silence League Radio Hour, brought to you by Lucky Mojo Curio Radio Network. And we have a full broadcast schedule this week and every week. Please look at the Lucky Mojo website for more details, the LMC Radio website, the Crystal Silence League website, our Facebook page, and also the Crystal Silence League newsletter. We also have our radio network lineup there. Very excited about tonight's program. We're going to discuss many, many useful topics concerning consciousness and mind. And I also need to remind you that the Crystal Silence League was founded in 1917 or so by a gentleman named Claude Conlon, who retired from the stage to help people with their spiritual life. He founded the organization as a prayer group to distribute prayer and positive images to people who needed it. And Crystal Silence League was reestablished in just a few years ago by adepts of the Missionary Spiritualist Independent Church, and brought online for various purposes, and we do have that at www.crystalsilenceleague.org. So please go there and check out our website and post your prayers, and prayer is always free at Crystal Silence League. As is our custom, every week we download and print some prayers from people who are in need of prayer, and we read those out loud, and so we're going to do that right now. So please join me in praying for the following individuals. I only identify these by prayer number and sometimes by initials, and to preserve the anonymity of the people who are petitioning for these prayers. So first is prayer ID number 36967 AC, who prays for us to help save her marriage. Her name is H, her husband C. They've had been separated for 2 months, and they haven't spoken in that time. And apparently the in-laws are encouraging divorce, and so please pray to save their marriage and heal the relationship. Prayer ID number 36966 AC. Also, another prayer to save the marriage. They're having problems due to psychiatric difficulties and other issues. Please pray to save that marriage as well. We have prayer ID number 36963JA, who is a disabled veteran with three children. And they need prayer. The husband has they've been having problems with intruders in the backyard, and they need help in this. They need help to know that they're going to be safe and that these intruders do not bother them. We have prayer ID number 36962, also from JA. The oldest son is to graduate high school, and he needs help in his studies, help in his studies so that he can pass all the right classes and not hang out with the wrong people. We have prayer ID number 36958AW, who has needs healing prayers for her physical and mental health so that no illness will interfere with her life, as she has many goals that she's trying to set for herself right now. We have prayer ID number 36957CR, who's praying for a loved one who prays that her best friend JH has the strength to move on from a toxic relationship with her ex. May she move on from that. And we have prayer ID number 36956AA, who needs prayer for her friend AE to heal, who's has an illness and needs to heal from it quickly and to clear up the past problems that the friend E has had. We have prayer ID number 36973DP, who's going for some job interviews and needs help and prayer that these interviews will find a job best suited for him. We have prayer ID number 36972ASK, who's praying for health of his lungs and bronchi. He's having infections and problems and needs help, and he prays for the medicine of God to heal him. Prayer ID number 36971NS, who needs relief from her headaches, needs headache for relief for her daughter S to get relief from her headaches, which have been nonstop for almost 4 years. May she be relieved of this terrible burden. And prayer ID number 36970S, who needs the safe and return of his S back to him. The days of suffering have taken its toll. The prayer ID number 36969EW has a general prayer request, who needs what is ever hindering his blessings, please remove it. He needs a call back to come in for training for this job and to be blessed in this new job that he's trying to get training for. Prayer ID number 36968SF, this is a court case. And they need prayer and general support for this court case to get disability benefits. And we have prayer ID number 36961JA, prays for, has problems praying, needs help in a court case with child support. The ex is still disputing it, and they're not getting any relief for this, so she's not getting enough money to get help for the children. Pray for justice. Prayer ID number 36960. Apparently there's been some problems around the house. Someone's been tampering with the home and vehicles. And so may justice be seen with that as well. Prayer ID number 36958AW needs improvement in her mental health and her physical health. And prayer ID number 36957CR is praying for a loved one, J.H., have the strength to move on from the problems that she's had in the past. May these prayers be answered, and may these people be healed. Amen. Well, gosh, we have so many things to cover tonight. First, I think we should discuss our crystal of the week, because it really has an interesting topic as far as I'm concerned. The crystal of the week is sodalite, and sodalite has a long history. The name is derived from the word soda and lithos, because it's a stone that contains a lot of salt. It has inclusions of calcium, salt, and manganese, all of which are very solid minerals. And it's an excellent stone for reducing high blood pressure. You got to carry it on you as a touchstone. You touch it a lot. You can use necklaces of sodalite that hang down as far as the heart area. and this helps increase its hypotensive properties. It's got a calming and regulatory effect on the thyroid. It does help all the glandular functions, and it helps you with self-confidence. It helps you with sticking to a project, sticking to a goal. In ancient types, in ancient Greece, artists and singers used to carry sodalite. It's believed to develop your musical skills, and it's very effective on the forehead chakra and forehead area. It's very good for headaches. If you get a disc of sodalite and freeze it, you can lay it on your head for migraines. Very good for headaches such as that. It is a long-term stone. It works best in long periods of time. You carry it with you over a course of time, and it seems to work best. It's not a short-acting stone. It's one that works over time. It's very deep blue, veined with white. Sometimes it's mistaken for lapis lazuli, but lapis lazuli has golden flakes in it, which is iron pyrite, not gold, unfortunately. And it's very good for, again, stress, nervousness, anger, fear, and you can use it to dispel fear and anger and guilt, these negative feelings. You can still the mind, relax the body, and calm inner turmoil. It's a very good meditation stone. You sometimes see it in chakra sets. That's the one that's used for the blue part of the chakra set. And it's very good with chakra work. It can help promote wisdom and calm. So sodalite, very sodalite or sodalite, very very good stone to have, not very expensive, very good one to add to your arsenal. And that is our stone of the week. Continuing, and as we marked, it's a pretty color, our chat room guests commented, it is a very pretty color. Our discussion of consciousness continues this week with the discussion of does consciousness exist independently, or is it a product of the mechanical body? And last week we discussed the Chinese room experiment about whether if you taught a computer to act as it had been understood, does it really understood? Does it really understand? And this is a very interesting question. And I'd like to talk to you about another thought project, a thought experiment that arose about 3,500 years or 2,500 years ago, about the time of the Buddha, in fact, but from the other part of the world in Greece. Plato, the philosopher Plato, who was a student of Socrates, talked about introducing new ideas, the idea of the mind when a person becomes becomes aware, mystically, a mystical revelation, when a person becomes enlightened, or when a person becomes aware of a level of existence that other people aren't aware of and attempts to explain it to them, as happens with a mystical experience. When you begin to do spiritual work and introspection, you are going to set yourself apart from most of the world who are concerned with material things. And you know, you have to believe and understand and realize that the world is very distracting. Sex and money and power and glitter, that's sensual pleasure, that's all very distracting. To turn inward, to turn into the spirit, to try to pick apart the very nature of existence, that's deep work. It's disturbing work, and not many people are called to it. But if you are, people are going to think you're crazy. And Plato illustrated this with an analogy or a metaphor that he called Plato's, known as Plato's cave. And it goes like this. Imagine a group of prisoners who are chained in a cave from birth, and they're chained in this dark cave with their back to the mouth of the cave, and they're raised in that cave from birth. And all they ever see of the outside world are the shadows cast on the wall of that cave. Occasionally a person might come by, a man comes by, casts a shadow, a woman, and echoes of that world enter that cave. And that's all they know of reality, are the shadows cast on the wall of the cave. Maybe even a tree, a shadow of a tree might come by and be cast on that wall. And they give these shadows names. They say, oh, that's a shadow, you know, that shadow, that's a man, that's a woman, that's a child, that's a dog, that's a tree. And that sound is the sound a man makes. That sound is the man a woman makes. And for them, that is reality. Now imagine one day one of these prisoners breaks free, and he goes out of the mouth of the cave, and at first he's completely dazzled by the light, and then he begins to see these objects of reality. Well, first, the shadows of the objects are going to be the things that are most clear to him, right? That's what he's used to seeing, are the shadows. The objects themselves are going to be vague and nebulous and not part of his reality. All he's going to see are the shadows. He's going to say, oh, look, a man. There's a woman. There's a child. There's a tree. And he's going to point to their shadows. But over time, he's going to make a connection that there's a higher reality, that the shadows are cast by something else. And he's going to make that connection that there's a higher reality. And his sense of reality is going to become more and more refined until he gets so sensitive to the reality around him, he can even see reflections in the water. And for the first time, he sees himself in the reflection of the water, and he recognizes himself. At which point, in great excitement, he returned to the cave and tried to describe this to his fellow prisoners. In great excitement, in great enthusiasm, he tries to tell them of this outside world. Rather than being met with gratitude and amazement, he's met with ridicule and humiliation and disdain, and often with violence. And this is what happens, according to Plato, to people who try to introduce higher realities or higher levels of reality to the common people. And in fact, it's what happened to his teacher Socrates. Socrates was put to death. He was executed, forced to drink hemlock for attempting to overthrow the natural order of society. And also part of that was corruption of youth. I'll tell you an interesting thing about that. When I was in college in the 70s, my history teacher, who was a retired Marine, said that that corruption of youth was homosexual behavior. And later on, when I learned more about Hellenistic Greek, I realized that couldn't have been true, because homosexual behavior was quite open and accepted in Hellenistic Greece. And if Socrates was playing around with guys, even younger guys, it would have been just accepted. Nobody cared. The corruption of youth was teaching them that the natural order that was taught by the authorities was meant to be overthrown and questioned. And so Socrates was put to death. So the if you want to read about Plato's cave and other incidences of both Plato and Socrates' philosophy, there's a voluminous series of books called The Republic that you can look into, and you'll find many of the ideas applicable as today as they were 2,500 years ago. And quite interesting, and to this very day, a lot of modern philosophy dates back to Plato. Of course, as I learned as a child, you can make anything you want out of Plato. If you think about that, that's really funny. So that's Plato's cave. And so what does it tell us, really? And that is that most of us go through life looking at the shadows and not looking at what cast the shadows, what's the higher reality. And so it's very easy for us to assume that the material manifestation is all there is, that the shadows cast by the brain is the reality of consciousness. And last week we talked about the idea that when you look at a brick, you're not looking at the brick, you're looking at a picture of the brick. Somebody got it. Plato. Someone got it. Plato. Did you see what I did there? Plato. You can make anything you like out of Plato. And that's called a pun. And Plato liked puns, by the way. Plato and Socrates both liked puns. So I'm up there with them. You see, I'm up there. The picture on the brain is what you're looking at with the brick is a picture the brain makes of the brick. And then you are what looks at that picture. And I've been bouncing this off of some of my friends who are very strict materialists. You know, they're functionalists. They believe that the consciousness is the brain. When the brain dies, the consciousness goes with it. And they've put me to the test in defending that. They really have. And I realize that it's not clear. A lot of them say it's contradictory. If consciousness is the picture and consciousness is what looks at it, there's a contradiction. And there only is if there's duality. If you assume that there's a difference between the viewer and what's being viewed, then there is a contradiction. But if there's a truth, if there is a truth in that reality consists of both the viewer and the viewed, and it's not separated, then there is no contradiction. that reality, consciousness, it is the same, and that what you're looking at is reality looking at itself, that reality is created by the act of observation, then there really is no duality, there's no contradiction. So, you know, let's go back to that. Imagine the television set with the picture projected on the television set. Well, obviously, the picture on the television set is not the real thing. Those are not real people. Those are not real cars. Those are phosphor dots or pixels projected on the screen. And furthermore, they're not even pictures of a real thing, if you can imagine that. Pictures of a real thing either. They arise from phenomena. They're electronic signals. They're electronic signals. They're not even pictures of a real thing happening. They're pictures of a picture. They're images of an image. They're shadows cast by shadows. They're fairy tales told by a ghost to his imaginary friend. And they're there on a screen. So we're watching a television show. That's the brain. You see, that's the picture. The television sets the brain. That's the picture. The viewer looks at the picture. You are the viewer. So what is you? You know, that, see, this question is, it's like peeling an onion. So then what is you? The brain is making the picture. What is you? Well, you is consciousness. You is consciousness. Consciousness operates the brain, yes. Consciousness makes the picture, yes. See, there's really no contradiction, because you can't make duality. Brain depends on consciousness. The matter depends on consciousness. It cannot exist without it. The brain can't function without it. And consciousness can't experience without the brain, without material reality. You can't, if you take consciousness away from rupa, it's called in Buddhism rupa, the solid, any part of it, everything falls apart. So you cannot experience reality without the reality to experience, you see? So there's really no contradiction. It's really the observer observing the observer. And it's not as complex as it sounds. It's only when you try to put it into words, everything falls apart. If you truly, as they say in Zen, you just sit and sit and breathe, it becomes very clear. You sit Zazen and you just sit and breathe. And I'm not a Zenist. I don't practice Zen, but sometimes that's a very useful thing to do. You just sit and don't think about it and just experience it. And you all of a sudden you go, oh, I get it. And you have this moment of Satori, it's called. It's kind of a taste of enlightenment. A Satori is a taste of, you kind of go, oh gosh, yes. And then you spend a year trying to unravel everything that you experienced in that moment. So it's kind of cool. How this affects us in real life, it's very interesting, but is it practical? Yes, it kind of is, because why do we do some of the things we do? We go through life puzzled by our own actions, don't we? We're motivated by things, and if you made a list of the things you're motivated by, you make a list. You say, okay, I'm motivated by, I want to be secure. I want to love and be loved. I want financial security. I want to feel appreciated. You know that before list number one, there may be four or five things pulling your strings you're not even aware of, you know, in your subconscious. There may be things motivating you don't even understand. Why do you get into a relationship and the red flags are waving, the horns are blowing, the danger signs are up, and you know that if you get in this relationship, you're going to be run through the ringer, but you do it anyway. What is motivating you to do that? And, you know, self-destructive, self-sabotage, self-defeatist behaviors. If you make a list of your motivation, you're not going to find anything on that list that says, I'm going to shoot myself in the foot, I'm going to set myself up for failure, I'm going to destroy my chances for success, I'm going to find love, but it's going to be love that's got a poison apple in it. What motivates you to do that? You're not going to find that on that list of things you make. So you have to dig deeper. And many belief systems have arisen to that. I want to bounce off you a term that came up to me when I've talked to a lot of people about this in my practice. People call me, and they've been in very bad relationships, relationships where they carry the brunt of the emotional burden, where they're involved with narcissistic people and abusive people and people with drug addictions and people who just take them for everything they have. You know, these are kind-hearted people, empathetic people who give and they give and they give, loving people, and often very functional people. You know, they have a very functional life. They're very self-aware. They put themselves through school. They have a responsible job, but their personal life is a shambles. They're married to somebody or involved with somebody, and this is men and women both, who destroy them, who just suck them dry. And you ask them why, and they sometimes have got a rationalization. I just thought I could fix him, or I fix her, or I thought maybe it would be. But why? Why did you? Why? And you know, I don't know. This is just, I can't. And so there seems to be a sense of emotional obligation, you see. And I've always said, do you feel that you're paying for something? You feel you're paying off a debt you owe. And this has seemed to struck a chord with a lot of people, that they owe, that they feel they owe. There's a sense of emotional obligation that they have to give a whole lot in order to get a little bit back. And some people have linked this to past lives. That, you know, it's a karmic debt from past lives. I think don't go there. For God's sake, don't go there. If you try to make up for everything you've done in all of your past lives, you're going to go crazy. And besides, you've done good in past lives, you've done bad in past lives, as far as I'm concerned, it's even. And if you're worried about your past lives, what about this life? How's that going to affect your next life? If you're spending all your time this life trying to make up for stuff you did in your past lives, what about the stuff you're doing in this life, the stuff you're not doing, the omissions? So when people ask me about past lives, if I do past life work, yes, I'll do past life regressions with hypnotism. But usually what I'll tell them is, you got your hands full with this life. Forget about your past lives. You got your hands full with this life. So concentrate on now. So why is there this sense of emotional obligation that we have? And you know, why do we shoot ourselves? Why do we do this? What, you know, what is the sense of that we owe, that we have to give so much to get so little in return? You see, isn't this part of the programming of reality? When you look at the brick, part of that look at the brick is that you want to pick the brick up and drop it on your toe, you know, or hit yourself in the head with it. There's a shadow that falls over your reality, your consciousness. And that's really what you have to do. When you make your list of motivations in your mind, you have to go past one. You have to go to negative integers. You have to go to negative one, negative two, negative three. You have to go to the subset of what's pulling your strings. And that sometimes takes a mystical revelation. That takes mystical work. That takes spiritual work. You're not going to do that just by logic. You can't look at your actions, your illogical actions, and come up with logical answers. That's illogical. That, you know, that sentence I just said is illogical, because it is. You're not going to look at irrational behavior and come up with a rational answer to it. You're not. Usually irrational behavior has irrational answers. You know, why are you afraid of things that aren't harmful? You know, there are people who are terrified of spiders, and most spiders are harmless. They see a spider, they freak out, they climb up on a chair, it's like, my God, it's, you know, their mind shuts off, they're hysterical. And I think that's a little wood spider, it's harmless. Oh my God, it's a spider or a snake. Most snakes are harmless. Most snakes are beneficial. They eat pests and things. And you know, you see down here in the South, if people see a snake, man, they grab something to kill it. And I'm thinking that's a grass snake. That's a little garter snake. It's harmless. It won't even bite you. It's a snake. Kill it. Oh my God. And so what's the programming there? Personally, I think that's the Judeo-Christian thing you're taught in some churches that Satan was a serpent, was a snake, and so they think that snakes are demonic, and that's what I think that is. My people, the Cherokee, thought snakes were beneficial. They thought they were teachers. You know, if you saw a snake, we had a pact with the king of the snakes, one of the folklore tales. We had an agreement with the king of the snakes not to hurt them. It goes way back, but they won't hurt us, we won't hurt them, but that's another story. So... So we are looking at reality, and I believe that we discussed that in Buddhism, reality is called the All. Buddha taught about the All, and he said that the All was everything that you could experience with senses. Reality was experiential reality. The All was experiential reality, and he said if anyone were to propose something beyond what you can experience as reality, he would be wrong. There's nothing that you can prove exists outside of experiential outside of experiential reality, that if you can't experience it, then it can't be real. Assume it, you can propose it, you can describe it, but unless you can experience it, it can't be real. Buddhism was very pragmatic, and that's one of the things that's very cool about it. There's not a lot of speculation, and one of these days, I'll tell you about the five inconjecturables that lead to fixation and madness. That's a very good thing, and I may even look that up now. I may look that up even as we speak. I have a new tablet that is supposed to be really, really cool. But so a mystical awareness is a sudden realization of an aspect of reality that's below the surface or above the surface. It's the connectedness of everything, and that everything is connected on a very fundamental level. And that what you see of reality, when you try to do a dualism, when you try to say me and that, or you try to say that and me and that, when you try to separate objects from their actions, you realize that's a falseness. And if you want to even break away from that into quantum physics, and I really don't want to do that because that's a topic of another show, but in quantum physics, objects are not objects, their actions. Objects are defined by their action. An electron is not an object existing in space. An object is defined by what it does, by its action, by its vibration, by its activity. And all matter is defined by its activity in quantum physics. It's what does it do? What's it doing? Its activity. And all objects really are their activity. If you think about a brick is not an object, it's an activity, it's an event. A brick is an event, it's a space-time event, it's being a brick. And so you cannot separate objects from its activity, but that's exactly what we do with speech. When we describe something, we have a noun and a verb. We have an object and its action. We have object and action, and really you can't do that. There's object slash action. Object and action are together. Space-time objects exist. There are objects. Space-time objects and how they interrelate to each other, that's the definition of reality in physics. There are space-time events and how they relate to each other. That is the definition of physics. And these are described with mathematical formula, mathematical equations. And that's the closest we'll ever come to describing reality, the mathematics of physics. And words can't do it. That's why in Buddhism, a lot of times they'll use allegories and parables and metaphors and try to take you away from words and into a startle moment, a moment where your brain disconnects and you get this satori, you get this moment of enlightenment, this moment of wisdom to break you away from constantly going around saying, this is this and this is that and this is the other thing and this is me and this is that and these are what I feel about these things and these are my opinions about these things, to just smack you and awaken you to the action of something. We discussed the Quan about the master who was looking for the leader of his new temple, and he put a vase of water on the ground and he said, "What is this?" And one of the monks said, "The moon reflected on the water." And he goes, "Okay, good." And then the kitchen monk, you know, the lowest of the monks, came in and kicked the vase over and walked out. And the master said, "Ah, we have our new leader." And you see why that was a better answer. First, it didn't use words. And secondly, it showed the activity of the vase. It was the activity of the vase. And what was the beautiful part about that, instead of hanging around, you know, kicking the vase over and then crossing his arms going, huh? Do you see what I did there? He kicked it over and left. It was done. He the action was in the moment, and he was gone. Bam. So that was just a beautiful answer. The vase of water, he kicked it over, showed the action, left. Boom. And I don't even know if he came back. He may have just continued walking. He may have been so enlightened that he didn't even want to be the master of that temple. He said, you know, moon on the water, my ass. Bam. You know, knock your there. There's your answer. And left and stayed in the cave. Because a lot of those guys did. There are things called Pachika Buddhas, who were silent Buddhas. They never taught. They achieved enlightenment. They went in a cave and just ran out the clock. So in Buddhism, there's a thing called luminous mind, sometimes called, I'll give you the long word for it, Prakiri Praksavara Chitta, or Pabahasara Chitta. And the mind, Chitta, is said to be luminous, whether or not it's tainted by mental defilements. Now, if you remove the mental defilements, voila, you have bodhicitta, you have Buddha mind. And that's a very desirable state to have, Buddha mind. You're enlightened, you achieve bodhi mind. And that is to remove the mental defilements. Mental defilements, basically, are, there's a list of them, there's 52 of them, in fact, if you look in the Abhidharma. But they're these things that we put into our mind that defile reality. A lot of them are negative. They're things like aversion and hate and desire. But a lot of them are things that are positive as well. Dependency on things for pleasure. Some of the things are delusions. Like you mistake you find permanence in the impermanent, lovely in the unlovely, and self-nature. Where there is no self-nature, that's the three grand delusions. There's a number of things. Some people see, they'll get into Buddhism and say, well, Buddhism teaches that reality is an illusion, reality is an illusion, that it's not real. And that's not what Buddhism teaches at all. Buddhism teaches that there is reality, but we just are mistaken about its nature. We think that what we see is real and permanent, and as it is, and what we see is not permanent. It's not it doesn't have a self nature, and it is not anything to get attached to. Here's something I'll tell you. If I were to put a piece of copper wire in an envelope and mail it to you, and you open that envelope and you remove that piece of copper wire, is it the same piece of copper wire that I mailed you? And a scientist would say, well, yes, it is. A Buddhist would say, well, no, it isn't. Causally related to the same wire, but it isn't. It isn't. In the time that I've put in that envelope and mailed it to you, it's undergone a lot of changes. There's molecular and chemical changes. It is not. In the same way, you can set an acorn, an oak tree, and a walnut pencil case, or an oak pencil case in a row and say, is that the same thing? And to a Buddhist, he would say, yes, they're the same thing. They're causally related. They're the same thing. And this is why it's told, and this is leading up to consciousness. Obviously, the acorn turns into the oak tree, and the oak tree is carved into the pencil case. They're the same thing. They're causally related. They're all causally related. But you look at them in different parts of their life, in different parts of their time, and you say, no, they're not. They're not the same, but they are. They're causally related in the same way that copper wire is. But you would say, no, they're different things, but they're really not. They're the same thing. They're causally related. They have the same point. They have the same point of origin, and they're causally related. They're dependently originated with each other. If you took yourself as a baby of 6 months old, yourself as a young man of 18, and yourself as an old person, and put them right next to each other, are you the same person? Are you the same person? Are those three the same person? And the answer to that is, well, yes, you're causally related, but no, obviously not. Looking at it from a strictly material point of view, obviously a six-month-old, a 19-year-old, and a 60-year-old, they're not the same, but they're causally related. They're causally related. Therefore, you, the beginning of the word you, and at the end of the word you, you're not the same person. The person who heard the beginning of the word you and the person who heard the end of the word you're not the same person. There's a causal relationship, but you're not the same person. And as you look at that brick and your mind makes that picture of that brick is undergoing changes of process that we have no way to fathom, no way to fathom. And this is why we have to think about consciousness and identity. Why is it when you go to sleep, you wake up and you're the same person. When you go to sleep and consciousness ceases, you wake up and you're the same person. And even more, how come, you know, I just had surgery, and, you know, they knock you out for that. You're gone. It's a black hole. You're gone. Consciousness ceases. What I remember is this. They came in and they talked to me. You know, my girl, Laurie, came in, and, you know, I was joking with her a little bit. And then they came in and they put the anesthesia, I guess, in my IV. And I was gone. Next thing I knew, I was awake. And they were trying to get me to eat a cracker and drink a Coke. And this 2-hour surgery was gone. Where was I? Where was I during those 2 hours that I have no memory of, no consciousness, no memory? And why didn't consciousness cease? Why didn't the chain of consciousness, what kept it going, in other words, what chain of causality, when the machine shut down, kept it going? Why, when it booted back up, was I still me? Or was I? You see? This is a question. These are the kinds of questions I ask myself. I think 99% of people wouldn't. They just, you know, they go down, they come up. For me, it was the blink of an eye. I shut my eyes, and I woke up, and I knew two things. I was really thirsty, and my shoulder really hurt. I was going, ow, ow, ow. Give me those pain pills, and it was done. I wouldn't have even known they'd done it. I would have just thought I blinked my eyes, except I woke up, and there was a big bandage on my shoulder, and it really hurt. And but where was I? Where was I during that 2-hour period? Where was I? Where was the ghost in the machine? And why did the ghost come back? And you see, these are the sorts of things that that we ask. And I'm going to tell you, in Buddhism, it's called the Vivekachitta. The Vivekachitta is the consciousness that runs as a thread of pearls between the other moments of consciousness, and it continues to run beneath consciousness when awake consciousness is gone. It also continues to run before the birth of the individual and after the death of the individual. It's there. It's always there. Consciousness exists as the fundamental component of reality. And we just kind of hook on when we're born, and we jump off when we die, and it never ceases. That Vanga, it's called Vangachitta, luminous mind, storehouse consciousness in Mahayana Buddhism. It runs at a low level. It's not sentient, and it's, if you can imagine it as a string of pearls, and awareness consciousness, you know, the parts of us that are making the pictures and sounds, kind of operates in between it. It's filled in between these other moments. I'm trying to think of a metaphor. Think of a string of pearls of white beads, with a space in between for black beads. And the black beads are what we see, hear, taste, touch, experience, and think. And the black beads alternate between the white beads of the Vanga Chitta. And I just made that up, and that's pretty darn good. And so when you sleep, all those black beads go away, and the white beads are still there. And that's the storehouse consciousness. There's a part of our makeup called perception, or Vanya, which marks things. When you eat a chocolate chip cookie, the first time you see it, you don't know what it is. So you mark it, you examine it, you conduct an investigation. You smell it, you see it, you taste it, you feel it, and these are attributes. These are marks, and you store that. So the next time you see a chocolate chip cookie, you don't have to examine it again. From memory, from perception, you go, bang, that's a chocolate chip cookie, and I like those. And those are part of perception. That's part of what goes into the Vivekachitta. That's down there. You don't even have to think about it. You go, chocolate chip cookie. So if you see an oatmeal cookie, you go back searching through and say, that's kind of like a chocolate chip cookie, but it's a little bit different. So you add to that. You go, now from the template of the chocolate chip cookie, you've made an oatmeal cookie. This works for and against you. If you encounter a snake and the snake is dangerous, Krishnamurti pointed out, that's all you need to know about snakes. You stop learning about snakes. And sometimes not all snakes are dangerous. So we tend to become complacent in our experience of reality. We run on autopilot. We think we know all we know about reality, and we stop paying attention, and we run our life asleep. We go through a lot of life on autopilot because we think we already know all about it. We wake up, you know, there's my wife, there's my husband, yawn, there's my coffee, yawn, there's my job, yawn, there's my car, yawn, there's other people, yawn, because we think we know all about them. Nagashima says ropes. Is that the metaphor about when you see ropes and mistake them for snakes? Yeah, there's a discussion in Buddhism about how sometimes you'll see a coil of ropes and your mind will mistake it for snakes because of an error in perception, because your mind will see this coil of ropes and say, ah, snakes, but then you investigate further and you go, oh, it's just ropes. And yeah, that's exactly right, because your mind goes out and looks for your perception goes out and looks for something that is close to the marks, and it says these similar marks match up, and then you get the picture of the snake in your head. And sometimes this can be so pervasive that you actually see something that's not there. That's why you look in the corner of your, if you're really imaginative, you look in the corner of your bedroom at night, and there's a shirt draped on a chair, and you wake up and you look over there and it's the booger man. That happened to me when I was a kid. I'd see all kinds of things. And I go, ah, mom, something's out to get me. She'd come in and turn the light on, and it was just a shirt on a chair. But boy, when I woke up and saw it, it was like some big-eyed thing trying to come get me. And, you know, who knows, maybe it was. And then it could turn into a shirt when the lights came on. You know, you don't know. See, that's just it. You don't know. And you know, there you go. And, you know, was it really my mind turning a shirt and shadows into this frog creature with fangs, or was it a frog creature who could disguise himself as a shirt? You see, in my mind, I don't know. You know, I don't just assume. So I always carry a charm that protects me from frog creatures. And, you know, you guys can determine if I'm kidding or not. But do I sound like I'm kidding? Reality for me is provisional. I've learned that reality is provisional. It's not something out there that's objective and written in stone and never changes. As far as I'm concerned, when I look away, the moon sticks its tongue out at me. You know, I don't assume it's always up there still and motionless. Maybe, you know, after these episodes that we talk about, maybe some of you may not be so sure about reality either. But that's some of the things that you start to think about when you think about your mind. And we know that the senses are not accurate gatherers of information. We know that. We know that when people say, well, I believe it when I see it, well, well, good for you. No, you won't. That means that what you're saying with that is that if you see something, that you're an errant observer, that you can't make mistakes, that your eyes and your mind are free from error. And I've had people tell me that arrogantly. They say, well, yeah, if I see it, I believe it. I can show you some stuff that, you know, I do card tricks. I can show you some stuff. And do you believe I can really make a king of diamonds turn into an ace of spades by sorcery? You know, but you'll see it. Do you believe it? You know, you can certainly be fooled. Your senses will fool you. Every one of them, every one of your senses will fool you. And when you mix them all up in your mind with superstition and with beliefs, and believe me, scientists have superstitions too. There are metaphysical assumptions of science. When you think about it, for instance, most scientists don't believe that there are ghosts. And most scientists don't believe in psychic phenomena, and most scientists don't believe in life after death. These are beliefs. There's no evidence one way or the other, no proof. So these are metaphysical beliefs that scientists have, even though there's no evidence one way or the other. And if science is supposed to be objective and they believe this, then these are metaphysical beliefs of science. And, well, you already hear my scientist friends try to wriggle out of that one. They said, well, I don't believe it because there's no evidence. And I said, well, then you shouldn't believe one way or the other. You shouldn't disbelieve. You should be pragmatic. You should suspend your belief. And then they get just as defensive as any fundamentalist. They say, well, I have a right to believe whatever I want to believe. Well, yes, you do as a person, but not professionally. Professionally, you do not. You have a personal set of views and a professional set of views. And you cannot bring your personal biases into your professional life. You cannot. You're not allowed to do that. So we have a set of philosophies that come up from way back And I want to tell you a story, while we still have time, I guess, about where these what these can lead to. There is a great discourse in the Pali Canon called, which I mentioned once before, the Maha Tanha Sankhara Sutta, the Greater Craving Destruction Discourse. And in this one, which I'm going to devote an entire episode to one day, I promise you, it teaches how to understand the relationship of consciousness to rebirth in a way that helps put an end to rebirth. And Tanasero Bhikkhu, who's a very respected bhikkhu or monk who does a lot of writing on Buddhism, points out that although the Buddha never used any word corresponding to rebirth in his teachings, he did describe birth as a process following on death again and again, as long as the appropriate conditions are present. In other words, even though he didn't use the word rebirth, and that's true, a lot of people say, you Buddhists believe in reincarnation. And so, no, reincarnation is Hinduism. We have a much more complex system than that. His teachings on birth are teachings on repeated birth, how it happens, how it inherently involves suffering and stress, and how it can be brought to an end. There's some background to this. The idea that death can be followed by birth was not universally accepted in India in the Buddha's time. Some prominent contemplative schools actively rejected the idea of rebirth, while others affirmed it. Thus, when the Buddha taught rebirth, he wasn't simply following an unexamined cultural assumption. He was consciously taking a stand on one of the controversial issues of his time. However, his explanation of rebirth differed from the other schools on both sides of the issue in that he avoided the question of whether or not there's a what that gets reborn, or there is a what that is. He also discouraged such speculations as, if I take rebirth, what was I in the past, and what will I be in the future? He put all these questions aside because they interfered with the path of practice leading to the end of suffering. Instead, he focused on the process of how birth happens, because the process involves factors that are immediately apparent to one's awareness throughout life and lie enough under one's control to turn them toward the ending of birth. An understanding of the process as process, and in particular, as an example of the process of dependent co-arising, can actually contribute to the end of suffering because, and this is very important, because it gives guidance in how to apply the tasks appropriate for the Four Noble Truths to all the factors in the process leading up to birth. The point is, and Nagasiva talks about, except for his rejection of Anatman or Anatta, Buddha rejected Atta, so he taught Anatta. He taught Anatta. He did. He didn't reject Anatta, but he taught Anatta. Atta was the idea of a soul, and Buddha taught Anatta, or no self. In Hinduism, there was a belief that you had an Atta, or a soul that transmigrated from life to life, accumulating karma. And karma was kind of the sticky substance that stuck to the soul and prevented transmigration to the Godhead. And various schools taught you how to get rid of this. You had to get rid of. And the Jain, which was a school that came up practically at the same time as Buddhism. In fact, Mahajira, the founder of Jainism, and Buddha were contemporaries. The Jains have a very strict rule of ahimsa. They don't they brush the road in front of them so that they won't step on insects, and they only eat vegetables that have fallen off the tree. A lot of times they'll eat trash, they'll eat discarded stuff. They end their life by laying on hot rocks and letting the hot rocks and the sun burn the last of the karma out of them. That's how they prefer to die. And Mahavira was a very strict teacher of suffering. They would put chains on their body and whip themselves and get that karma out of there to free the spirit. Buddha rejected the idea of mortification of the flesh. He taught the middle path. He tried that. He tried the mortification path, and he almost died. He was born a prince, under unimaginable luxury. He rejected that, and he taught a middle path, a path of moderation, of a contemplative path of moderation. And that doesn't mean that you pick two extremes and pick the middle. That means you hover above extremes, that you avoid extremes, and keep a sense of equanimity and balance. So in Buddhist time, there were all sorts of schools that taught how to deal with karma. You refined it, you rejected it, you went ahead of it. And Buddha saw karma as a psychological principle, and he was the first person to ever see this. He saw it as action and the results of action, and that consciousness was conditioned by actions. And when you committed wholesome activities, your consciousness was conditioned by that, and it bore wholesome fruit both now and in the future. And if you committed unwholesome actions, you know, word, speech, word, action, and mind, thoughts, you know, thoughts were mental, you know, fabrications were mental, physical, and verbal. In any of these activities, if you unwholesome activities planted seeds that would blossom in the, you know, not only now but in the future. For the one thing, it conditions your mind. Unwholesome activities coarsens your mind. It makes your mind coarse. Makes it more likely you're going to do unwholesome activities. It's more likely you're going to kill again. If you indulge in pornography, it's more likely you're going to do it again. If you indulge in sexual misbehavior, it's more likely you're going to do it again. If you indulge in intoxicants, it's more likely it coarsens your mind. But if you indulge in wholesome activities, you know, kindness and charity and spiritual activities, it refines your mind. So he taught that karma, rather than being this mystical force, was a psychological principle that refined the consciousness, and that it was inevitable that actions would always manifest in a fruiting. So a lot of times we say the fruiting of karma, that there was karma and vipaka, action and its consequences. You know, people say things like karma means what goes around comes around. No, that's really not what it means. And if you wait around for somebody to get the just results of their actions, you're going to wait a long time. You may not see it. You may not see it. It could happen now, or it could happen 1,000 years from now. That may have to be a topic of another time, because we're running out of time. But Buddha, rather than deal with metaphysical questions like, is there a soul? Is there an afterlife? Is there an origin of the universe? He set those questions aside and rather offered the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble Path as an alternative to these questions, as a practical way of living a wholesome life, of refining your consciousness, of directing your life toward a more successful and wholesome level on every aspect. He taught high spiritual seekers, you know, the bhikkhus, the people who turned away to direct it, but he also taught ordinary people like you and me how to live a better life, laymen, how to pursue a better life, how to get rid of those things, as I said earlier, those things that lay beneath the surface that make us do these bizarre things. Coming up next, and we'll continue this discussion next week, and I believe I'm going to have a special guest, in fact, next week. Coming up next in the Streets of Beverly Smith, which is a special rebroadcast, by the way. We have a link for you in chat. Do join us next week, and thanks for hanging around. This has been John St. Germain, Crystal Silence League Radio, LMC Radio Network, brought to you as always by the good people at Lucky Mojo Curio Company. See you next week. Thanks very much. Keep us in your thoughts and your prayers as we do you. Do visit us at www.crystalsilenceleague.org. Subscribe to our newsletter and join us up and get our publications. We have a new book coming out, and good night.